Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Dr. Tim Child is a leading expert in fertility. He's an Associate Professor of Reproductive Medicine at the University of Oxford, and he has published over 100 research papers and has introduced new fertility treatments in the UK. He co-wrote the current NICE fertility guidelines and was appointed to the HFEA board in 2021. He chairs its Scientific and Clinical Advances Advisory Committee, and he's responsible for the add-ons traffic light system that the HFEA has recently introduced. Dr. Child is a trustee of the Fertility Alliance charity, and he was honoured with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the European Fertility Society in 2021. Hello, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you. And like what we're going to cover today is so important because, you know, we often cover the male side and, you know, what people go through, what how they can get treated and a lot of that side. But actually what certainly Kieran and I found, and so many people that we speak to, is that when you're on the other side of that and suddenly that's all finished and then suddenly it's your female partner who picks everything up from there, is that you suddenly realize you don't know anything about it. So that's what we want to cover today, and just to really give guys that insight as to what's coming next, because as we actually covered on a previous episode with Tracy Sainsbury, is that men often do just focus on where you are now rather than really going many steps ahead, which females do. So yeah, it's a fantastic opportunity to really bring to life what that entails. So, and that's kind of where I'd like to start really, is when what is commonly termed as going through IVF, when that does start to happen and it, as I said, it moves to the female side, what does that entail in a kind of nutshell, if possible?
Yeah, so I mean, the main part of an IVF cycle is the woman having a daily injection for about 10 to 14 days, and that's a drug to stimulate the ovaries. She should probably have a couple of monitoring ultrasound scans during that time in the clinic. And then after the 10 to 14 days of the daily injections, there'll be an egg collection done under anaesthetic. If a fresh sperm sample is being used, then the guy will be asked to produce a sperm sample at that point. Or if there's frozen sperm, either because it's donor sperm or it's been taken from a biopsy before, it'll be thawed out and put with the eggs to make embryos. The embryos nowadays are then normally cultured on for 5 days in the incubator in the lab to what's called the blastocyst stage. And then usually the best single embryo goes back into the woman through her cervix with a procedure a bit like having a smear test. If there's any spare embryos left over, they can be frozen. And then about 2 weeks later, she would do a home pregnancy test. So the whole treatment is roughly about 4 weeks for what's called a short protocol cycle.
Yeah, that's I distinctly remember that, you know, that kind of that process. And, you know, me and Sean have talked several times about the fact of you're the focus for a period of time as the male that suddenly become identified as, you know, being infertile. But then that almost the responsibility of everything suddenly falls on the woman. And there's a lot of guilt and emotions linked to that as a man. But what, in preparation for like an IVF cycle, what kind of tests, like initial tests, would we expect like our partners to have to go through? And why do they go through them? What's the point of each test?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, normally by the time a couple get to an IVF treatment, and we're talking about people with fertility problems, because often IVF can be done for people who are just wanting to freeze their eggs to preserve fertility, and that's sort of a separate thing. But if we're talking about a couple, you know, heterosexual couple, for example, with infertility issues, then generally there'd have been, you know, sperm tests on the male side. On the woman's side, the sort of tests that would be done to see why the couple aren't getting pregnant might involve a check of her fallopian tubes, maybe a check to see if she's ovulating. But most women with a regular menstrual cycle, over 90% of them are actually going to be releasing an egg each month. But then the most important test from an IVF point of view is to measure her what's called ovarian reserve, because it's the ovarian reserve test, which is the single most important test before a woman goes into an IVF cycle. It used to be, the way we used to do that test was with a blood test called FSH, or follicle stimulating hormone. It had to be done between about day 2 and day 5 of the cycle, so it had to be timed in. If it was done wrong, the result was all over the place. But the problem with the FSH result was it was affected by other stuff that could be going on as well. So the results weren't that good. So that sort of slightly fallen by the wayside. And now the main test is something called AMH, or anti-Müllerian hormone, which is a blood test. So all IVF units nowadays would be getting the woman to do an AMH blood test. It can be done any day of the menstrual cycle, and you don't get much variation between 2 or 3 tests, for example. So just one test is enough. And that AMH result is the one that's used to decide the drug dose for IVF, maybe even the type of IVF. And the only other test I'll mention, well, the main other test is a thyroid test. So women would be having a what's called a TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone test, to make sure that the thyroid gland is in your neck, to make sure that's working okay. And then I guess just to say, all people going through IVF would also have virology testing, hepatitis and HIV. And that's more really about storing egg, sperm and embryos rather than looking for an underlying problem.
Yeah, in terms of, that's really the amazing information there. And it's something that I wish I had, because I remember going into the clinic and thinking, I don't have a clue what's going on. What kind of time bracket, you know, if you could put your typical, stereotypical kind of time bracket in terms of someone first coming to see you to when all those tests are done and they're ready to go, because it's something that people often ask, like, how long is it going to take? And I think, especially for females, partners, I think they like to have that plan ahead, don't they? Where men, we, like Sean said previously, we kind of just think, right, what am I doing today? I've got to go to the clinic for this test. Let's get the test done and then we can move on. So what kind of time brackets are we looking at in terms of being seen to treatment starting?
I think it's a really good point. I think often where, you know, when I see patients, often what happens is they've sort of read stuff, they've had some tests at the GP, they've had another test somewhere else, they maybe done a home test or something or other. And often what hasn't happened is often things haven't been drawn together. So there's just sort of stuff out there, and it doesn't make sense, because it's just bits and bobs here and there, stuff their mum has told them, stuff their bloke down the gym has told them or whatever. Some of it right, some of it wrong, some of it, you know, old wives' tales type stuff. And so certainly, when you then go to see particularly a fertility specialist, what the fertility specialist should be doing is drawing everything together. And I always want patients to leave with a plan. And the plan might change, and that's okay, but to leave with a plan, and very importantly, an agreed plan. So not a plan of me saying to the patient in a very old fashioned paternalistic way, this is what's going to happen. It's okay, well, these, you know, hopefully there might be more than one option, but these are the options. What should we agree on is probably best for you. And what might be right for one couple might be different for another. So I've had some patients where they've come in and maybe they've been trying for however long it might be. And I can look at the test results and say, well, there's no reason why you shouldn't get pregnant naturally. It hasn't happened yet, but maybe focus on lifestyle and fitness and whatever it might be. And, you know, maybe give it 6 more months before jumping into spending lots of money on IVF. And you might have other couples who say, well, I'm not interested in that. I've been trying for 12 months. That's way too long already. I want to go straight into IVF. So it will vary. But to answer your question, I would say it can depend whether they're NHS or privately funded. Unsurprisingly, private can happen quicker. I would say in general, particularly nowadays, most clinics will offer some sort of fertility MOT type thing, or, you know, maybe not a one-stop assessment, but bringing things together more quickly. And in general, once you've got the test results there, if it's looking like IVF is the way forward, then really you should be able to start within a month or two. By the time, because normally after you see the doctor, there's the more consent forms, which are often done with the nurse. There might be another scan to do or something, but it shouldn't take more than a few weeks to get that done.
Yeah, I found because I obviously had NHS for my first child, Sebastian, and private for my daughter, Enya. And it was significantly different. It was a lot more waiting on the NHS because obviously there's a lot more, I wouldn't say there's more hoops to jump through, but in terms of funding and things like that, it was trickier. And I also found that when I had my NHS treatment, it was very much, this is what we're doing. And this is what we're doing. Where in the private sector, it was a lot more discussion about what we wanted. Now, if someone is in the NHS sector and they don't fully understand or feel comfortable with something, they're in their rights to kind of say, can you explain this a bit further and kind of why are we doing this?
Definitely. And I think one thing to say is that, the hfva.gov.uk is a good website to look at. A bit biased because I'm on the board of the HFVA, but the hfva.gov.uk website has lots of information on there about funding for IVF and background information about issues with fertility, and obviously all the tutor fertility clinic stuff on there as well. But interestingly, I think most recent data, I think one in three IVF cycles in the UK are NHS funded, but a big proportion of those are happening in private clinics. So many people who have NHS funded IVF are in a private clinic setting. Now, if you're in a private clinic setting, to be honest with you, the clinic shouldn't care whether you're NHS funded or you're paying for it yourself. The quality of treatment should be exactly the same. And if it isn't the same, maybe question if that's the right clinic for you. If you're in an NHS IVF unit that's owned and run by the NHS, I think sometimes that can be affected by NHS staffing and various other things that might be causing an issue.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's really good to hear, you know, that you have those conversations with people and give them that tailored advice. It's good to know that it's happening. To touch upon something that Kieran mentioned earlier, that guilt, I so clearly remember that because, you know, I felt so responsible for it. And I know I don't want to use the word fault, but that's what I felt at the time. It's not a nice thing to say, but I felt that this was my fault that we were here. My wife never said that. She never made me feel like it, but I felt it. And it was particularly challenging when we came to start the injections because my wife had a massive needle phobia. And suddenly we're at home with all of these needles in the cupboard, all this medication in the fridge, and we were just left to do it, obviously under very clear guidance of what to do and when. And you mentioned protocols earlier, Tim. I remember each time we did it, we did the long protocols. So What is the difference between long and short? And is there any difference between them in terms of, like, is one better than the other?
There are lots of different types of IVF protocols, but the two main ones would be the long or the short protocol. And if we go back 15 years ago, 99% of people would have had the long protocol. In the last 5 years, there's been quite a big shift towards a short protocol. Now, the difference is that if you just give stimulation drugs to the woman, as I said at the beginning, there's 2 weeks of daily injections to stimulate the ovaries. If you just do that, and that's how IVF started back in the 70s, the woman will ovulate. So you have to watch very carefully when she's about to ovulate and then get her in at 3 o'clock in the morning to get the eggs out before she ovulates. And that's how IVF was until the 1980s. And then it was discovered that if you give a drug called an agonist, and if you give it for 2 or 3 weeks before you start the daily stimulation injections, it switches off the ability to ovulate. So it's a way of controlling it, which then means that as an IVF clinic, you can just do egg collections Monday to Friday in the morning because you can control when the ovulation trigger, the late night trigger, is being given. So the long protocol was the standard worldwide IVF way of doing it until a few years ago. The other way is the short protocol. So with a short protocol, you just go straight into the daily stimulation injections, but you have to give a second injection to switch off the ability to ovulate. And that is called an antagonist. So if you do a short protocol, normally on day 2 or 3 of the period, the woman will start the daily injections. Then about a week later, the second injection, so the antagonist, will be added in on top. And then that will stop the woman ovulating. Now, in answer to your question, which is better, there's been this long-running debate about it. And in the UK, clinics stuck with the long protocol, the older way, for a long time because we were convinced that it worked better than a short. On the continent, they'd all switched over to the short. We thought, they're just bloody continentals. They just sort of gone. They've gone short. They've gone early with it. And then about the big advantages of the short protocol is the risk of OHSS, so ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, is about 2/3 less for the short protocol. But there was a concern we had in the UK that the success rate was less. So we didn't really use it, apart from for women at high risk of OHSS, so particularly women with polycystic ovaries. But then about during COVID times, most clinics switched over to the short protocol because we were really trying to avoid people getting OHSS and then ending up in hospital. So clinics switched over pretty much across the UK, and we actually saw the success rates the same. So people prefer a short protocol because you don't get the menopausal symptoms that you do with the long protocol. You get less OHSS, and obviously the clue is in the name. It's quicker, it's shorter. So most clinics now will probably be doing a short protocol for everyone, and we think the success rate is the same.
Yeah, that's really crucial information. And in my uninformed opinion, but you mentioned something that was coming up for me. It was that sounds like essentially science is mimicking the menopause there.
So yeah, with a long protocol, if you have a long protocol and you have these 2 or 3 weeks of this daily injection or a sniffer before the woman starts the stimulation, it switches off the hormones from the head that drive the ovaries on. And because it switched those off, the woman will have a lack of estrogen, so she'll get menopausal symptoms, the hot flushes and sweats, but only temporary, so only for 2 or 3 weeks. And then once she starts the daily injections, her ovaries will wake up again, they'll produce estrogen, and then the symptoms will go away.
It's incredible, you know, how we have got to this point where we can do that. It really is. It's remarkable. And you've mentioned OHSS, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, a couple of times there. My wife, unfortunately, did get that. And it, as well as being, like, she was very poorly, very poorly. And it was also heartbreaking because we had gone for so many years of like the investigation's been on my side. Suddenly we thought this was the light at the end of the tunnel, our first go on IVF. And as it would have happened if we had not got the OHSS and had the fresh transfer, the 2 week pregnancy test would have been, I think it was Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, and we were like, it's destined, it's mad, it's meant to be. And suddenly that was ripped away. And the hardest part psychologically for my wife, aside from the physical nature of it, was the fact that she was so bloated that she looked 6 months pregnant, which is what, you know, we both wanted so desperately. And that is what she has mentioned a few times as being her lowest moment with it all. But so what is OHSS?
Yeah, so it's ovarian hyper, so hyper means high, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, and it's an iatrogenic, which means it's caused by doctors. So it's an iatrogenic condition. It has been reported happening naturally, like one in a multi-million, but basically it happens in response to stimulation drugs. So you can get it in response to Clomid tablets for ovulation or low-dose ovulation for IUI treatment, but that's very unusual. It tends to go along with the higher doses of stimulation that are used during IVF. So what happens with OHSS is the fluid leaks from the blood vessels into the abdomen. So the woman's pelvis and abdomen, if it's severe, and it's severe in about 1% of IVF cycles, so fortunately it's not common, but it's not rare either. And if it's severe, the woman will get bloating because of either fluid, or you can get some gas buildup in the bowel, but fluid in the pelvis. If the fluid is a lot, it can then push up on the diaphragm, and women can get, people can get very, very short of breath. They can't lie down flat because they find it difficult to breathe. If it's not managed properly and if it's severe, it can be dangerous because it can cause the blood to thicken and to clot. So the management for people who are heading into OHSS, well, first of all, the way that clinics try and avoid OHSS is they look before the woman starts treatment, they're trying to identify people who are at increased risks. And I've already mentioned that having polycystic ovaries or a high AMH is an increased risk factor. So what the clinic will do is they will lower the starting dose of stimulation. They might use a different type of stimulation drug. They'll use a short protocol. And then you'll notice that when you go in with your partner for the ultrasound scans during the IVF, they're measuring the size and the number of all of the follicles in the ovaries, and they'll be plotting them on a chart. They might be altering the drug dose. But very importantly, when it comes to if the follicles are big and there's a good number of them and you're getting towards the egg collection, there might be a discussion about the type of trigger to use. Now, if you're in a long protocol, there's only one trigger that you can use. It's called HCG. If you're in a short protocol, another advantage of the short protocol is there's a choice of two types of triggers. There's the HCG one, but that can trigger OHSS. But there's one called an agonist trigger. Now, if you have an agonist trigger, the risk of OHSS drops down to about 10% of what it would have been. It's a massive drop. But normally you have to freeze all of the embryos, so you don't have a fresh transfer. So the final way of reducing the risk of OHSS is to not put an embryo back. Because what makes women really ill if they got OHSS is if they get pregnant. And that can be, because that can then go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. So the way that clinics try and minimize OHSS is the right dose, the right drug, careful monitoring, a decision over the trigger, and very importantly, a decision about avoiding pregnancy, which means freezing all of the embryos.
Yeah, ours were frozen. Yeah, that was the advice. And and I remember the shortness of breath and just being so scared. And
There's nothing. The horrible thing is, if a woman gets OHSS, you can't make it go away any quicker. The treatment is supportive treatment, so it's literally just waiting for it to get better. And there's nothing you can do to make it get better quicker.
Yeah, we obviously my wife has polycystic ovaries, and she was on, they were on high alert for her, you know, in case of OHSS, and it occurred, and we had to freeze embryos, freeze everything. But just to reiterate what Sean said, it's a terrifying thing to watch, right? Because she just got bloated, she became quite unwell and quite significantly uncomfortable and a lot of pain. But it was the case of, you've just got to sit it out and see what happens. And luckily our body did what it needed to do. I remember it really well. Like, it was really quite a traumatic thing to experience when you've already dealing with quite an emotional and sensitive subject. But that actually, we went from a long protocol, because we were on a long protocol then, and we switched to a short protocol, and her body responded so much better to that. And Seb came on a short protocol, and then we used a short protocol as well for Enya. The evidence suggests that her body didn't like it, so let's not use it.
When I think back to 10 to 15 years ago, when basically everyone was on a long protocol, and at the time the clinic I was working in Oxford, we were doing 2,000 egg collections a year. We were one of the biggest clinics in the UK, so a big, busy clinic. And if you think about it, you know, 1% of 2,000 is 20 people. And if you get OHSS, you're in hospital, and it's severe, so you're in that 1%, you can be in hospital for a week or so. So pretty much half of the year, we would have a woman on the gynae ward with severe OHSS. So we were just always over there. It was almost like there was a bed in the corner, but we didn't feel there's any way of stopping it. Whereas nowadays, with the short protocol, agonist trigger, freeze all these sorts of things, it's almost unusual to have, people might get OHSS, but it's unusual that it's as severe as I said. So that's been a major advance.
So in terms of, are there any kind of early signs for it? Or is it literally like you're looking at the size of the follicles, and when it gets to a certain point, it's kind of like, right, we've got to reduce this now to stop this escalating?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, there's been loads of studies over the years trying to see, is there a really good predictor that you can say you're going to get it, you won't get it? And unfortunately, there isn't. It's just this continuum. And then it's just a risk, you know. So it's you have a discussion with a patient, and so a younger age, more follicles, previous OHSS, these are all higher AMH. These are all relative risk factors. It's not a black or white thing where you can say you're going to get it, you won't get it. And so, not surprising. And the other thing to say with OHSS is it comes on after the egg collection. So if you don't give the late night trigger, you will not get OHSS. It's impossible. It's that late night ovulation trigger which triggers it. So often what happens is you might have someone who's at increased risk of OHSS, and you might say, I think we need to use the second trigger I mentioned, the agonist trigger, but that means we're going to freeze all of your embryos. And they might say, yeah, but I feel absolutely fine. I don't want to freeze my embryos. I want to have a fresh transfer. But they feel fine because they've not had a trigger yet. So you sometimes get in a situation where patients might be saying, well, I'd rather take the risk. And I've had situations where we said, well, I'm not happy to take the risk. So as a doctor, we're not going to do that, because sometimes we have to just take control of that situation. That's unusual, because most people do not want to get sick, obviously, with OHSS. But until they've had it or they've seen someone with it, they might not really know how nasty it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is something that once you've seen it, you definitely don't want to see it again.
Yeah.
But
I think both of you, from what you said, both of you, your wives had it with a long protocol, it sounds like. Yeah. And then they didn't have it. Obviously, on your side, Kieran didn't have it, the short protocol. So
not at all.
Quite telling.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were describing it earlier, I was thinking, hey, that's joined up a few dots in my head. So I've definitely learned something today in terms of the higher risk with the longer protocols. But I think it's important that listeners understand that for some people, a longer protocol would be more appropriate, and their bodies would respond better to that. It's just obviously listening to, the professionals in the clinic as you're going through.
But I think that's something discussion to have in the clinic. So when you're in the clinic and the doctor says, okay, well, this is the AMH and this is what, and rather than just leaving the room thinking, well, they haven't even said what type of protocol we're going to have, it's a question for the team. Say, well, what type of protocol is it? Probably it's going to be a short protocol, but some people feel that for women with a very low AMH, a very low ovarian reserve, a long protocol might be better. So there's some studies suggesting that lower ovarian reserve, long protocol might be better. I've had some patients where they're not at risk of OHSS, and we have switched backs and forwards between long and short just to see whether one suits the patient better than another.
Yeah. Yeah, that's understandable, isn't it? You've got to gather the evidence to know how to kind of have a treatment plan. Obviously, the aim is to get to egg collection. That's one of the, I always, like I've just said, it's about, for a man, it's about what's the next stage. And I distinctly remember the egg collection being up there, level of importance. Could you just briefly describe for the listeners, like what would happen on egg collection day, maybe from that trigger to what egg collection happens, and maybe possibly from your experience, how women may feel around this time? Because I remember feeling like I was walking on eggshells quite a bit and not really knowing how to support my wife into something that I had no idea about.
So I mean, essentially what happens is the clinic will probably be doing a few egg collections on that morning. They're normally done in the morning because insemination of the eggs happens usually about 4 hours later, and it just sort of, egg collections in the morning fits in with the workflow of an IVF lab. That's why they're done in the morning, really. So if the clinic is doing the egg collection at 9 o'clock in the morning on the Wednesday, the late night trigger in most clinics is given 36 hours before. So that'd be 9 p.m. on the Monday, which is why it's often called a late night trigger. Some clinics might use 35 hours or 37 hours, but usually it's about 36. People obviously get really focused. It's got to be done to the exact minute. I mean, yes, should be done at that time, but I wouldn't worry if it's a few minutes here or there. Now, once a late night trigger's been given, then the clock is ticking then, and the IVF unit will have told you to come in probably half an hour or an hour before the egg collection time. They probably will have told the woman to have had the last food maybe 4, 6, 12 hours beforehand. Again, that will vary from clinic to clinic, and maybe to have had clear fluids just until 2 to 4 hours before. So again, they'll give you advice on that. You'll come in there if you're using a fresh sperm sample, again, they'll have advised that the last ejaculation should have been a certain number of days beforehand, so that the sperm is in best quality on the day. And then when you get in there for the egg collection, then the doctor doing the egg collection will come and ask the woman to sign a consent form, and they'll explain the procedure. What they'll say to you is that, okay, we're going to take you through to the egg collection room. The anaesthetist will put a drip into the woman's hand. Usually the partner does not go into the egg collection room. We used to have them in there in the old days when the sedation was different, but nowadays that would probably be pretty unusual. So I put a drip in the hand, give you a bit of light sedation. It's not a general anesthetic. So a general anesthetic is what you'd have if you were having, you know, your gallbladder out, which means a GA is when your muscles are paralyzed and you have to be on a breathing machine. Now, you don't need that level of anesthetic for an egg collection. That the risks of a GA, which are very low, but they're still too high for what's needed during an egg collection. So most clinics will use what's called conscious sedation, which means you're asleep, but you're still breathing yourself. The woman's still breathing, but she won't remember what's going on. Or she won't remember the procedure. So there'll be some sedation in, and then usually after the woman's sleepy, there'll be a vaginal scan probe with a needle on it. So it'll be the same as the scan probes that have been used to measure the follicles, except it's got a needle on it. The scan looks at the ovaries, and then the ovaries just sit at the top of the vagina, and then the needle just goes through the vaginal skin at the top of the vagina, and then under scan guidance, the doctor will then use a foot pedal, and it aspirates the fluid out of each follicle. And they'll go all of the follicles in a row, and then they'll pass the fluid from the follicles in a test tube. The really old-fashioned name for IVF is test tube babies. Literally, the only time there's anything to do with a test tube is when the fluid from the follicles goes into a test tube. That goes through to the lab, and then egg collection is over. The woman might go to recovery for 20, 30 minutes or so, and then back round to the whichever room you were in to start off with. And if a fresh sperm sample is being used, the guy will normally be asked to produce a fresh sperm sample around the same time as the egg collection is going on. If it's a frozen sperm sample because it's donor, or it's been frozen from a previous ejaculation or from a surgical sperm retrieval, it will be being thawed out about the same time as the egg collection. They put the eggs and the sperm together, you both go home, and then the next day you'll get a call from the lab, which is saying to you how many eggs have fertilized and what the fertilization result.
We want to tell you about Impril, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Impril is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Impril by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, there's a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
I don't know if I was fortunate enough or I had the experience of going into one of my wife's egg collections.
Okay.
And like many things I've said today, it's an experience, you know. It is something that, it's really testing on their bodies, you know. Mm. And I think that if you do get the, I wouldn't say if you do get the chance to do it, but I think like if you, you know, feel comfortable with seeing that, have a good think about it. But from both our successful cycles, I didn't go in for the egg collection. I think the one I did go in was around, was it just after COVID? It was around there because Enya's that young. It was in that mix, and it for some reason I was allowed in. But the work they do in there is absolutely phenomenal. And as you're describing it there, like, it is incredible what you guys do. Like, absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. We used to, so back before, I mean, many clinics, if you go back 15, 20 years ago, many clinics would not have an anaesthetist come in for the sedation. Mm. So the sedation was given by the gynecologist doing the egg collection, which meant you had to use quite a light sedation, because you're doing the egg collection and you're also giving an injection, egg collection injection. So again, here in Oxford, we used to have the male partners in, but every now and again, one of them would faint. So it wasn't a great scenario because you're trying to do an egg collection and you've got some guy who's like looking a bit woozy, then he's on the floor. You think, I've got two patients here and I've only got one pair of hands. And you got, you know, you're doing an egg collection. So personally, I was quite happy when we moved away from having guys in there.
we've spoken about this before, but also I distinctly remember the wonderful work the nurses did with my wife then. Really knew what to say. They did some fantastic work with her, and my hat off to the whole team that were there and continue to do this. This happens every day. Like, it's a phenomenal thing. So obviously, if we've got our, we've collected our eggs, we've got our embryos, it's gone to blastocyst, as we've discussed. What does transfer look like? Transfer day, because it was, it's probably, apart from testing for the pregnancy, it's the biggest day on the map, isn't it? Like, this is what we've been waiting for.
Yeah. So what it looks like is, I mean, medically, it's a pretty straightforward procedure. You don't need sedation for it. I mean, sometimes if it's occasionally, transfers can be very, very difficult, maybe because the woman has an issue with the cervix. So occasionally they are done under sedation, but that's pretty unusual. So they're normally done, as I mentioned earlier on, just like having a smear test. Usually, I mean, nearly always the partner can come in for that. It'd be pretty standard that partners can come in for the embryo transfer. What will happen is, and this is true for fresh or frozen, if it's a frozen transfer, the embryos normally would be thawed out on the morning, you know, even whilst you're on the way into the clinic. But you get into the clinic, you probably go into the room, the embryologists will say to you, okay, well, they'll confirm, you know, the names, your names, they'll confirm what they're putting back. So they'll be saying to you, right, how many embryos are we putting back? Now, nowadays, most people have one blastocyst, which is a day 5 embryo, put back, because that's best success rate with least risks of multiple birth and therefore just least risk overall. So most people have one embryo back nowadays. They'll be confirming that with you. And then what will happen is the woman will lie down, she may put her legs up in some stirrups. There'll be a speculum, which is like what's done during a smear test. And then there should also be an ultrasound scan on the abdomen. So there's really good grade A evidence that the live birth rate with an embryo transfer is higher if there's also an ultrasound scan being done of the uterus. And what will happen is the doctor or nurse, and the success rates are the same with doctors or nurses, you know, they'll be trained to do it. The embryo will be loaded up into a little embryo transfer catheter, which is a very thin straw, and then that'll be passed through the cervix under scan guidance, and you can normally see the catheter going in. Now, if you as a patient can't see the catheter on the screen, don't worry about it, because you're just looking at a mass of things moving around. It's not really there. I mean, it's great if the patient does see it, but that's not why it's being done. It's being done so that the doctor or nurse who's doing the transfer is happy that the tip of the catheter is in the right place in the uterine cavity. And then they'll push on a syringe, or the embryologist might push on a syringe, and you might see a flash. And the flash you see on the screen is the air in between the fluid bubbles, and it's because air shows up as black on a scan. So you often just see a flash there, and then they'll take the catheter out. The embryologist will then flush the catheter through in the lab to make sure that the embryo has left the catheter, because sometimes you'll see a flash, they'll take it back, and the embryo is still there. It's just sort of got his elbows out. So then what you do is, it's called a retained embryo, then they'll just go through it again. If that happens, it doesn't affect success rates at all in a bad way. It just means they'll just have to have another go at it.
I remember that flash. I remember the flash. And they said, if you watch carefully, because I couldn't see the...
Exactly.
The actual, what they were putting in. But then you saw the flash. And it was almost like, oh, it's there. Like, it was a real kind of moment in the whole journey. For me,
it was. Call it the flash of life or something.
Yeah.
I think I've heard it referred to that.
But if people don't see it, it's because I have had patients who've been really upset that they've not seen it at all. And they're worried that it's not gone back. It's not in the right place. Because sometimes you just don't see it. It just doesn't show up because there's a bit of shadowing from the scan. And that doesn't matter.
I wasn't allowed in. It was COVID time, so I definitely didn't see it. But I remember, I cannot remember if it was the egg collection or the embryo transfer or both. But my wife was told very clearly, do not wear perfume. Yeah. Is that a thing, and why?
Yeah. So many IVF units will say, so no, I mean, certainly you'd never have embryologists wearing perfume or aftershave in the lab. And it's because of the particles can be toxic. So, you know, most IVF units will say to all of their staff, so even ones who aren't even anywhere near the lab, but because they're obviously interacting with people who work in the lab, not to wear any perfume or aftershave, just because because it can be noxious, I guess, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, brute. No, so that's really interesting. Are there any other do's or don'ts when it comes to kind of that clinical procedures like egg collection, embryo transfers?
I think, as is generally the case, just get as much information as you can. And if you feel as though the clinic, maybe you've got information from the clinic, but you'd like to understand a bit more about it, or if you or your partner's very, very anxious about it, ask if you can see the egg collection room before you go down there on the day. And most clinics will be absolutely fine with giving you not a full tour, but just taking you downstairs and saying, okay, this is where you'll go before the egg collection, in your room or behind a curtain. This is where you'll go for the egg collection, just to sort of demystify it a bit, so things don't get built up in your mind about what it's like. People get understandably really worried about the pain side of it, but you know, with the modern sedation that's given, it's not a deep sedation. People sometimes think, well, that means I'm going to be really aware of what's going on, but that's actually very unusual. And the anaesthetists are very skilled at giving just the right amount so that it's safe, and the recovery is really quick, but people are essentially sort of sleepy and still, which is important for the egg collection safety, and then don't remember anything afterwards. And they'll wake up and go, is that it? Go, you know, I don't remember anything about it.
Mm, yeah, brilliant. And McDonald's fries following an embryo transfer?
So I was asked I did the BFN stuff before, and that's one of the first questions I was asked, actually. I've never even heard of that one, and it still makes me chuckle whenever I hear it. But yeah, I don't know where that came from. I mean, I think there's this whole thing of intralipids, which intra means inside, and obviously lipids is fat. So there used to be a vogue a few years ago for some women having an intravenous infusion of intralipids for sort of immune type things. I mean, in my opinion, absolute load of rubbish. There's no evidence or science behind it at all. So I don't know whether the whole McDonald's fries thing came from there. And I guess if people feel they want to have intralipids, which I think they shouldn't have, maybe go and have some fries instead.
I think it's a very clever marketing tool by McDonald's. They saw the market and they went, right, we can get on this, lads. I've got another. We kind of skipped ahead earlier. I wanted to ask you, lifestyle changes for women, obviously preparing for a fertility treatment, are they similar to a man? I mean, can they do these things together to make it easier, or is there any specific things that women should be doing that men wouldn't?
It's a very good question. I think it's the same. I mean, really, it's optimizing general health and nutrition. And there's no reason really why it should be any different. So from a dietary point of view, I think if you go back a few years ago, there was never any advice given on this at all. It was just ignored, to be honest with you. There's much more out there now about it. And studies are still not great quality studies, but there is some evidence that sort of Mediterranean start type diet, so you know, a multicolor, fresh cooked sort of stuff you get on a nice Mediterranean holiday, maybe not sort of a doner kebab, but the other sort of, you know, the obvious type of good Mediterranean diet stuff, it's full of natural antioxidants, and there's some evidence that can improve embryo quality, particularly if the embryo quality was poorer to start off with. BMI is often spoken about, and you'll often hear, I did a post about BMI and had a bit of people saying, but it's rubbish, you know, if you're really muscly and whatever. Okay, maybe. But relatively few of my patients with a BMI over 30 is it because of muscle mass. That's pretty unusual. I've had a few Marines who've come in who've been like that. Yeah, okay. But for many people, it's not. Most people with a BMI of 34, 35, it's body fat that's the high BMI, not muscle mass. So that is why the NHS have a BMI cutoff of 30, because there are good quality studies showing that as the BMI goes above 29, for women, the live birth rate drops away. So even though BMI is not great, there is still a link. So I think optimizing general health and weight, however you want to think about that. And then smoking is really bad for fertility, very, very bad for male and female. That would be the big one. Caffeine and alcohol, I'm probably a bit more relaxed about that. Again, studies have looked at that. And my view would be that if people like to have a few glasses or a couple of beers a week, and that helps them relax and that helps them de-stress, not a problem. There is no evidence that stopping alcohol completely improves live birth rates with IVF. So, and my view always is, it's very easy for people like me to say stop that. But if that is going to make someone more, maybe not stressed, but something that they're avoiding, something which helps them relax, that's not beneficial.
Yeah. In terms of alcohol, please correct me if I'm wrong, it's the fact of it's excessive use of it is the damage. Yeah. But I think that's just life in general. If you drink too much, your body slowly dies. It's a toxin. Yeah. One of the first things that I'm going to go is the ability to produce good, or your fertility levels to be high, because you're working away at your body with toxins that shouldn't be in it, really. But I think that's really useful for people to hear, especially our listeners, in terms of, I distinctly remember thinking, has Jen got to do this and I've got to do this, but actually you can do it together. Yeah. And this
and it'd be more thing, it'd be more successful doing it together as well.
Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really hard if it was on one side and someone's trying to really chip away at that BMI, for example, and the other person's just cracking open a dairy milk every night because they don't have to, then it's going to really affect the other person. And it's that kind of thing, if we're in it together, and if the food's not there in the house or the drink or whatever, then it just makes it easier and it breaks down the barriers to hopefully then get you where you want to be.
And you're supporting each other as well with it. It's a joint journey going forward. So obviously IVF is a joint journey. You're both going through it. Even if there's donor being used on one side, you're still going through it together. And the more support there can be for each other, then the stronger you'll be, the better the success rate will be, I think.
Yeah. Brilliant. So there's something that I keep seeing. It's not something that we considered when we went through. It's not something that we heard about, but I keep seeing it talked about, which is pre-implantation genetic testing, PGTA. What is that, and what are the benefits of it?
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. So it's been around forever. Not forever. It's been around since the 1990s. It used to be called PGD. So if you look at older stuff, PGD is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. But about 5 years ago, it was sort of split up into different types. So now it's called PGT, so pre-implantation genetic testing. So what it is when embryos get to the blastocyst stage, so day five, six, or seven, rather than just putting them back into the uterus or freezing them, what the lab can do is to make a hole in the outside of the embryo with a laser, and then to take some cells away. So you might take 5 cells away out of the 150 cells that are there in a blastocyst. The blastocysts are then frozen, and then the cells are then sent off to a genetics lab, and they're analyzed for their DNA. And there's three main reasons to do it. One is the couple might have an inherited disorder in their family, cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, anything. So it can be analyzed for that to see which embryos have got the condition and which don't. And that is called PGTM. And that is normally done on the NHS, usually for people who don't have fertility problems. Their problem is they've got a serious inherited disorder. What you've asked about is PGTA, and the A stands for aneuploidy. And aneuploidy means wrong numbers of chromosomes. So when people make embryos, a surprisingly high proportion of the embryos will have the wrong numbers of chromosomes in and won't be viable. So normally those embryos won't implant or they'll miscarry. Some wrong numbers of chromosomes will make it through to live birth, so Down syndrome, for example. But that's actually there's actually very few types of wrong numbers of chromosomes that make it through to live birth, most just won't implant or they'll miscarry. So there's a theory that if you do PGTA and you on say someone has four blastocysts, a couple have four blastocysts, that by doing PGTA, the idea is you can find the embryos which are viable more quickly than just putting them back and seeing what happens with nature. Now, it sounds like a really obvious thing, as in, well, of course it's going to work. But as with many things, just because the technology's there, it doesn't mean it helps. And this is another perfect example. So there's been some big studies that have been done that in couples where the woman is really in her sort of mid-30s or below, whether you do PGTA or whether you just put the embryos back, surprisingly, the live birth rate is exactly the same. There's just no difference at all. For women in their late 30s or into their 40s, then there may be an advantage of PGTA, but the advantage is by avoiding embryo transfers. And what I mean by that is if someone is age 42 and they have an egg collection and they make some embryos, and say they make three embryos, three blastocysts, and patient number one has those embryos put back and doesn't have a baby, patient number two has PGTA and all of the embryos are abnormal, neither woman has a baby. So PGTA has not helped anyone have a baby, but it's avoided patient number two having embryo transfers. Or if you have another scenario where one of the three embryos is normal, patient number one has an abnormal one put back without knowing, doesn't get pregnant, then has a normal one put back and has a baby. Patient number two only has the one that's normal, it goes back and has a baby. So the chance of having a baby is the same. But you might avoid unnecessary transfers. You probably reduce the risk of miscarriage. So there are some advantages as well. But it's not an open or shut case.
Brilliant, thank you.
I'm conscious. You know, we've been talking for nearly an hour now, and I feel like we could talk to you for ages, Tim. While we're having this discussion, more questions are coming up in my head. So yeah, at some point, we'd love to have you back on to kind of further
this discussion
about just educating men around what females experience and what to expect about the whole process, because it is so daunting. But before we get on to like how people can contact you, we always like to ask, I guess, one question specifically, and that is, what one bit of advice would you give a man that, in this case, is supporting a female partner through the IVF process? If you could give him one golden nugget, what would it be?
I think my advice would be to just get informed, because knowledge is absolute power in this situation. And I think knowledge, but make sure the knowledge is from a good source, because there is so much rubbish that I see that's written out there, right? Stuff that's just wrong, and that might be put out there by people with really big followings, but it's not correct. So I think get well informed, but make sure it's from reliable sources. And I think by the better informed you are, it will help you make an informed decision that's right for you and your partner. It'll help you be more supportive for everything. You'll have more of an idea of what's going on during the treatment that we just spoke about, you know, what goes on during an egg collection, embryo transfer, what is it about embryo quality, all that sort of stuff. So I think gain knowledge, but make sure you get it from reputable sources.
Thank you. That's amazing advice and something I think we will both echo, you know.
Yeah. No. Yeah, Dr. Google is not the one.
which is powerful. I mean, again, if I think, obviously, I've been doing it for a long time, you know, before the bloody internet was invented. So, I've seen, you know, the rise of Dr. Google, good and bad. And my view always is, you know, when patients come in and they've been on Dr. Google and they come in and they say, well, I've read this and that. I love that. I love that discussion with people. And of course, it's not that everything I say is right or I know everything. Of course, I don't. But hopefully, I've been doing it long enough and I know roughly what might be right or wrong from experience, but also from the studies and also where to look. But as I said, you then try and get an agreed management plan with the patients so that they walk out feeling that they are in control of the situation, but also that it's logical, the route that they're off, go heading down.
Yeah,
I think one website that I found extremely helpful and is really set out really well is the HFEA website, which I know you're involved with. You're on the board, you know, full of a wealth of experience and knowledge behind what's going on that website.
Yeah. There's some information out there. And I think, you know, what you guys are doing as well, there's great support. I think the webinars that I've seen where you've had specialists come on and talk about things, again, that's powerful information there for people.
Yeah. I found as well that I found it all quite daunting where to go and what to do. And I found that actually if I spoke to my wife, you know, she knew a lot what was going on and she could explain it to me because they like that plan. So talk to them.
And then
you can inform yourself through their guidance sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
It's been a fantastic discussion and we know that our listeners are going to get so much from it. If people would like to contact you, how can they do that?
So I have a Instagram channel, Dr. Tim Child, and on there I do Instagram lives where I get people just typing questions in, and obviously very fortunate you guys agreed to be with me as well, so I've done one with you. I've got a lot of stuff on there. On my website is drtimchild.com, and there's information on there. I see patients in Oxford or online as well, so if people want to have a consultation, then that's also available through there.
I have to say your Instagram is brilliant. It's so just easily understandable, and that is, it's like I said about the HFEA website, that's what we need in situations where there's a lot of emotion, upset, trauma, panic, grief, all these things swirling around, to get something that's easily understandable, legible. It is like, you can't put a price on that. So thank you for what you're doing in your own time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at The Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.